a lot of black hole solutions, black holes, black brains in a variety of dimensions, but at no point have I sort of said whether these are sensible solutions to be looking at. So in four dimensions, we kind of believe that black holes are out there in nature and that they are stable, because obviously if they were in nature, they would have to be stable. But how do we address that question in the context of general relativity? And so the answer is, if you want to check if a solution is stable, you perturb it a little, have a look at what happens. And a stable solution, well, it might wobble a bit around and sort of shift and distort, but it should remain close to the background, unperturbed solution at all times. An unstable solution, on the other hand, will tend to roll off and go somewhere else. And so, although looking at perturbation theory will give you a clue as to where it might run off to, it may not exactly tell you what happens. So,
excuse me? Can you turn your microphone up?
Sorry about that. I thought I had turned it on. Do I really want to repeat that?
So we're going to look at perturbation theory to see whether the solutions that we've been looking at make any sense, okay? And the answer is going to be some of them do and some of them don't. Anyway, it's a way, if you keep your microphone off, it's a way of making sure that only the people here have that extra special input, you see. This is your secret bit of, bit of discussion. So the question that I'm kind of running around here is looking at issues. We're going to look at black brain solutions. Because we already have the tools to actually make a pretty good guess about stability issues. So let's just look at a particular example. Of a five-dimensional black hole with radius R plus and compare it to the black string. So our black string is going to be a cylinder of radius RS and have length L. So the area of my black hole the area of a three sphere is 2 pi squared R cubed. The area of the black string is 4 pi RS squared L. The mass of the black hole, well, I wrote down this general formula for the mass in arbitrary dimensions. And if you remember, it had factors of the area of a unit d minus 2 sphere, as well as other sort of combinatorial factors, and of course, an 8 pi g. So in this case, our mass, if we work it out, I'll put the individual factors there. So that's my mass of the black hole. And the mass of the black string, asymptotically, in, if I'm looking at Kaluza-Klein theory, is basically RS over 2G4, which is RSL over 2G5. So if I want to look at the entropies, I simply take the area over 4G, but then if I re-express that in terms of my mass, so I hope you can read all that, I see that the entropy of the black hole is proportional to the mass to the 3/2. So I've simply noticed that this depends on R plus squared, and the mass depends on R plus cubed. That's basically what I'm doing, modulo some factors. Whereas for the string, I can see that my area is proportional to RS squared, so that's going to look like a mass squared term. So what I see there is on the left-hand side, I've just got an entropy involving some constants plus m to the 3/2. But on the right-hand side, I've also got the mass and the length. So at fixed mass, if I increase the length, eventually this entropy is going to drop below the entropy of the black hole. So this is telling me that if I believe in black hole thermodynamics, then it's saying that just by an entropy argument, if I keep this, if I'm looking at the same mass object, but I increase the length of my compactification, at some point the entropy of the black string will be less than the black hole. And so the mass contained in the black string would kind of prefer to organize itself as a black hole. And so I can see this by expressing my black string entropy in terms of the black hole entropy. When I rearrange my constants, I suppose I don't really care about the numerical factors. The important thing is that you see this ratio of RS over L. So for a given thickness of string, I've got a critical length above which my black hole is the preferred state. So all that really is there is it's a very simple argument. We've said that if we've talked about black hole thermodynamics, I gave you a sort of Euclidean argument, a Euclidean partition function approach to computing the entropy, and also a Euclidean method for determining temperatures of black holes. But in some, because we don't see Hawking radiation, and probably realistically can't because our black holes in nature are just too big, somehow black hole thermodynamics, it's cool, it's interesting, but it somehow doesn't seem within the realms of sort of testability. Here, on the other hand, we're looking at something which again is using these abstract ideas, but it's telling us something about a classical solution being unstable, and that's something we can test. So whereas the arguments about entropy involve concepts and techniques from quantum field theory, this is a statement about a classical solution. So we can actually go out and see whether it happens. So in order to do that, we have to learn about perturbation theory. So perturbation, yep.
One thing with respect to this, so when we did this Euclidean trick, we just identified that the entropy can be written as the area over 4G, right? Mm-hmm. But why should I expect that here the same argument of maximum entropy will work? Like saying that the preferred state would be the black hole when you go down the critical length, why is that?
Well, because if I increase my length, it's saying that eventually this black hole is going to have higher entropy. So it's fixed. So I've got, you know, I have a particular configuration. I'm comparing two different solutions. I identify what the mass of each is. And then I say if this one becomes too long or relatively skinny, whichever way you want to put it, then the entropy of this solution is less than the entropy of that solution. The only charge they're carrying is the mass, so the only thing they have is mass. And so that would say, just thermodynamically, that this state would be preferred. So that the black string can increase its entropy by clumping into a black hole. So it's a heuristic argument. It's simply saying, looking at the areas, it looks as if this thing is preferred, okay? So it's at the moment, that's all it is. It's just saying, look, here's a thermodynamic argument which says, maybe this thing has an instability. But in order to see whether or not it does, you have to perturb this solution. And in order to do that, you have to know how to deal correctly with perturbations in gravity. So another reason perturbation theory is useful is that it's difficult to deal with, to find a lot of exact solutions. So there's a question at the back.
Isn't the topology of the space-time different in the two cases? So mm-hmm. I'm kind of confused how one can turn into the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. We'll see. There are topology-changing processes in gravity. There are tunneling processes which change topology. So, but those are sort of obviously inherently quantum mechanical. Formation of black hole, that changes things too. So, okay. So the other reason that perturbation theory is useful is because it is hard to find exact solutions in gravity. Therefore, if we manage to, say in cosmology, we describe our universe by an extremely special metric. We say it's homogeneous and isotropic, and we write down a metric that depends on a single function. Now, there is no way that really describes the universe around us, because we're here. So we're definitely not homogeneous and isotropic. Our solar system exists. So clearly, we're not exactly homogeneous and isotropic. And the way we deal with that in cosmology is we say, well, on the big scale, we look like this. But then we start adding little bit of wrinkles and see how they evolve. So we say the overall impression of our universe is homogeneity and isotropy, but then we pan down to fine detail by using perturbation theory. And then again, that sort of gives us a more refined picture, but again, if we want to look in more detail, say at formation of galaxies or stars, we can't even do perturbation theory, you then have to go into a nonlinear level. So you kind of, the more you come down in scales, the more you have to deal with nonlinearities. But perturbation theory gives you a very useful way of moving off special solutions. Also, when we do solar system tests of gravity, we do them via a prescription of perturbation theory. So again, we're testing Einstein gravity by stepping beyond Newtonian gravity. And so that's how we test. First of all, we confirm Einstein gravity to leading order, but then it's how we kind of push it to see whether there's anything which is non-Einsteinian in our universe. So there's a whole sort of industry or a whole formalism going beyond the linear theory, or at least beyond just straight Newtonian theory in our solar system. So what we do, the idea of perturbation theory is that our metric, and apologies for using HAB, which I know is the first fundamental form, it's just that H is absolutely conventionally used for first fundamental form, and conventionally used for a perturbation of the metric. It's even worse when you're doing perturbation theory for brain worlds when you already have a submanifold. So you just have to kind of use context to decide which one it means. But then I guess English speakers are used to that, things being ambiguous. So what we're going to do is we're going to write our Einstein equations in terms of our background known quantities and this HAB, but we're going to neglect terms of order H squared. So this is the standard procedure that you do for perturbation theory. So my perturbation of my connection I write it down in full. Would have all these terms. But again, I can use a normal coordinate type of argument. To re-express this in terms of a set of covariant derivatives. So remember, the normal coordinate argument would be that the background gamma vanished, so all these derivatives inside here of G would have no contribution. So the bracket would be order H, which means I can forget about that. So I would simply have some derivatives of H, but again, partial derivatives in normal coordinates are the same as covariant derivatives. And so that then is a tensor expression. This is a tensor. And so I've done my job, but if you like, you can manipulate all these derivatives here to see that this is, in fact, the correct expression. And so my perturbation of my Ricci tensor
demand the matricity condition to hold, right? So the covariant derivative of G is zero.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a reason that this new perturbed metric should not satisfy that? So like, why aren't all the covariant derivatives of the H's also zero?
So because your covariant derivative, when you hit each side there, if you're saying that the covariant derivative of G is zero, it's the covariant derivative with respect to the metric G, which is not the same as the covariant derivative with respect to G naught. So on the left-hand side, you'd get zero. On the right-hand side, you've got grad G of G naught and grad G of H. So grad G of H is just grad G naught of H, right? Because you're already at order H. Whereas grad G of G naught is grad naught G naught, which is zero, and then the delta gamma piece. So, so we know how to compute our variation of the Ricci tensor. Remember, that was that Palatini lemma. Okay, so my delta gamma is given in terms of covariant derivatives of H. So here I've got the first three terms come from this first piece here, where I'm simply inputting the expression for delta gamma CAB. And you'll notice I've been quite careful about the ordering of the covariant derivatives here, because covariant differentiation doesn't commute on tensorial objects. So that's why I was trying to pay attention to the indices that I was writing. So you'll see these first three all start with a grad C. And then the last one, delta gamma AAC, ACC, if I look up here, you'll see that's just the covariant derivative of the trace of your perturbation. And so the last term just gives me the second derivative of that. Now, what I want to do is I just want to reorder those derivatives here so that I get a divergence or a partial divergence of this perturbation. So I'm just going to reorder the derivatives using the Riemann identity. So here, if I swap the order of differentiation here, I can do that, but at the price of introducing a Riemann tensor with the final two indices being the CA, and then I have to replace in turn each of these indices here, the C and the B. So here, the first one is where I've replaced the C index, so that's sitting up there. And then the second one is where I replace the B index. But I've also got another Riemann term coming from there, where I replace the A index. So those two give me that term there. And then the final piece is replacing the C using the Riemann identity. And then I've got minus a half box H minus a half. Times the second derivative of the trace. So I can now group all this lot together. So here's my piece that I would expect, actually. It's the wave operator of my perturbation. So that's kind of good news, because if we're sort of imagining that we're looking at perturbations around some background, we normally expect some sort of wave equation. So that's a promising start. Then we've got this Riemann term here. Which I've just slightly reordered. Then here you see that I've got a Ricci tensor with the A index and the B index symmetrized. So that's another piece which is geometric. It's got a physical meaning. Now I've got to group together the remaining derivatives of H. You can see here I've got these terms which have a divergence, and I'm symmetrizing on A and B. And so I can rewrite those as the divergence of a sort of combination of my perturbation. I've taken my perturbation and subtracted off a trace term. So that's just rearranging all of those pieces together. So this thing in brackets is called the Lichnerowicz operator. And it's the curved space wave operator for your tensor HAB. So at the moment, I've just gone through this. I've expanded my Ricci tensor. I've got an expression for delta R, and so something that ought to vanish if my Einstein equations hold. There's a lot I haven't discussed. I haven't said what it means to be small. I've just assumed that we know what that means. But that is an issue that you do have to just bear in mind, because what does small mean? Size is defined via the metric. And of course, we can make coordinate transformations on the metric. So how do we know really what physically it means for H to be small? And so all I can say is, in the main, when you've got an exact solution or a known background solution, you kind of do know what it means. It's sort of clear, but it's something you have to explore in a given context. It obviously doesn't make sense to say that individually, every single component of HAB has to be small relative to G0AB, because, for example, a lot of the metrics we've seen have no off-diagonal components, for example, Schwarzschild. Whereas a perturbation, we might expect to have an off-diagonal component. And so G0 TR is zero in Schwarzschild, So any HTR is going to be big compared to G0TR. So it's not just naively looking component by component. So as I say, it's typically, once you're in a situation, it's clear what it means, but it's just something to bear in mind that it's, don't sort of stick to it rigidly component by component. Another obvious issue which is related to this is if your background metric has singularities, then again, it's going to raise an issue of what you mean by having a small h. So it is, so it is something we will have to just keep an eye on. If you have coordinate singularities, it can sometimes be a little unclear. Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate a little bit, please, on about what, just as with an example, how you can determine like h is small?
Yeah, we'll be seeing that. I'm going to talk about the black string. Okay. So in that case, we'll see how we're going to decide what we mean by a regularity, or in other words, you know, this perturbation being small for HAB. It's so at the moment I'm asking you hold the thought because we will see it, you know, in an example. So the it is non-obvious. I mean, you know, I think you have to sort of see it. And I mean, I think if you're in flat space, then it's fairly clear what it means. Because in flat space, so in flat space, you've got eta AB is your Minkowski metric. And so all those components are just one. And so you would simply say, well, in this case, I would just say that the size of every component just should be less than one. So that's an example where it's straightforward. And then you would just look at solutions, and you might, you know, notionally introduce an epsilon, say, and you know, as a small parameter to expand in.
Like using what you say about eta AB, could you not do some sort of comparison in a local sense?
Yeah. So what you do, what we'll do, is in the end, with Schwarzschild or Schwarzschild-like solutions, you're going to have to go to a local Kruskal system. So that's what you have to do. I just don't want to do it in detail now.
Okay.
So.
And just one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you use any sort of thermodynamic quantities to indicate, like, for example, thermodynamic properties of the perturbation alone versus G0AB and compare those to arrive at some sort of comparison?
So I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean there by thermodynamic quantities, you know, exclusive to HAB. So,
like, if H, you have your black hole.
Yeah.
So that's your basic. If your basic Schwarzschild metric is your G0.
Yes.
And you're perturbing.
Yeah.
And if you just consider your our perturbation separately as just an independent addition, so to a black hole, you're adding, for example, probably doesn't make sense, but like a star, just as if it's engulfing the star. So can you study properties of the other metric independently, the perturbation independently, and compare those to your...
Well, I don't know what you mean by independently, in the sense of what you're doing when you look at this wave equation is you're looking at H on a given background. And so typically H, because that's, you know, this is it's a wave operator, you've got four coordinates, you've got hidden away in that, you've got Riemann components, Ricci components, connection components. You know, it's quite a complicated system. And so what you end up doing, because your background has a lot of symmetry, what you end up doing in practice is decomposing H with respect to symmetries of the background. And so usually when you're actually down there sort of with your sleeves rolled up, tackling H, your background has left a very strong imprint on the way in which you're describing H. So you can, and in fact we do, regard H as a field living on some background. So it does have that interpretation, yes. So we do think of it that way. But it's also true that the way we describe H is quite in, you know, entwined with our background as well. So it is true that we would imagine, for example, if we were perturbing a black hole, that we would not be shifting the temperature much, we would not be shifting the entropy much, because that would be part of what we would mean by small. So it's all, you know, that's why I said case by case. I said in practice, you can see what you mean by small. So let me move on and discuss gauge choices, because I've already said how coordinates can be important. In general relativity, because we choose coordinates when we're finding exact solutions to make our job as simple as we possibly can. So a gauge transformation is simply infinitesimally adding, moving a small piece along a vector field. So we write a gauge transformation as x goes to x plus xi, where our xi is just moving a little bit along some vector field. G goes to g plus the lead derivative of g along psi. Which is the symmetrized covariant derivative of psi. So if psi were a killing vector, g wouldn't change at all. So a coordinate transformation induces a perturbation in the metric. So this is why doing perturbation theory in gravity can be a bit of a minefield, because simply shifting a coordinate will induce a perturbation in our components HAB. But that's not a physical perturbation. So what we're going to do, as always, so this is not an unfamiliar setup about a gauge transformation, giving us a shift in a gauge field, but we're going to make use of that. We're going to use it to fix gauge to make our problem easier. So if I look at what happens to this barred H, I'm actually dropping the noughts on my metric here just for
simplicity here. So my barred H changes by the lead derivative of the metric along psi and the divergence of psi. So if I take my divergence of this, then I get three pieces. Once again, I can see that if I swap the order of differentiation here, I can cancel off the final term. And so I do that at the cost of introducing a Riemann piece. So again, I use the Riemann identity, but you can see that, in fact, although I have a Riemann tensor, it's going to be summed. And so what I actually get is the Ricci tensor. So what this is now, again, a wave operator on a vector field, but corrected for the fact that you're in curved space. And this is, if I set this equal to some source, that is a well-posed differential or set of differential equations. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, if the divergence of my perturbation, the H bar associated with my perturbation, is non-zero, then I'm going to solve that equation of motion with this source being the divergence of whatever my physical perturbation is. Or original, the originally the way I wrote it. So what that means is I can choose my gauge to set that term to zero. That's all that's saying. So that means that the real wave operator, so in fixed gauge, so this is called a D'Hondt gauge, so my wave operator now clearly contains just physical terms, yes?
When you did first, you mean a perturbation to the metric plus perturbing the tensor itself or the components of the tensor in a coordinate space?
So the way that's... What did I write down? I think I'm working in abstract index notation here. So it's really a perturbation of the manifold. I'm really thinking about perturbing the manifold. So I'm pretty sure I'm working in abstract index notation here. So I'm imagining that when I write down G as G naught plus H, that is in a real sense, you know, perturbing my tensorial object.
It's a perturbation. Why is that? Because if I make a coordinate transformation, then G
then
doesn't change.
Right. I am sure there's a way of making this work. It's just eluding me right at the moment. So you really are perturbing the manifold. You're imagining taking your space and wobbling it a bit. I'm saying if I shift the way I describe my metric, then I shift the components of the metric. So in that sense, I've looked at it in terms of components. It's right on the edge. Is anybody sort of less? So what you're saying, so maybe, yeah, I think, as I say, I can sort of, it's right on the edge. I think we're going to have take this discussion offline because I've got quite a lot I've got to get through before I finish, which is probably why I can't figure it out sort of, you know, on the spur of the moment. It's fairly straightforward, but I'm just not. It's sort of one of those things where, like with anything, if you want to get nitpicky, you've got to kind of sort of sit back, relax, you know, your cup of coffee, and sort of say, right, I'm going to get this straight. So you can certainly see at least what I've written down in terms of components makes sense. So the only thing that's kind of bothering me about that is the fact that I bet there's also perturbation of your vector basis as well. So that could be where things are hiding. Okay, we better drop that, otherwise it's just going to be, we're not going to get there. I can see we're not going to get there. So I've still got some remaining gauge freedom in spite of having fixed my gauge. Are we still, can we leave that? Can we shelve it till the end? So we have some remaining gauge freedom, whereby as long as I preserve the fact that I don't get any contributions from the divergence of H bar, this is what I need. So as long as my gauge transformation satisfies this wave equation, then I can make this transformation on my components of my perturbation. So let me just count degrees of freedom. So I start off with HAB, which has D into D plus 1 over 2, components. So those are D into D plus 1 over 2 different functions. I then say that it satisfies the Donda gauge, so it satisfies this divergence condition. So that is D constraints. And then finally, even if I satisfy that, I've still got some gauge degrees of freedom. And so my original D into D plus 1 over 2 components, I've killed D of them from my gauge conditions. And of the remaining components, D are also gauge. So the physical degrees of freedom are D into D plus 1 over 2 minus 2D, which is D into D minus 3 over 2. So in four dimensions, I get two physical degrees of freedom, which is what I expect, two physical propagating degrees of freedom.
There were D constraints, and where did the other factor of D come in from to make it 2D?
Because of the fact that you've got, of the remaining components, D of them are gauge. You've got these gauge transformations here. Satisfy that. So that agrees with what we expect for gravity in four dimensions, that we should have two propagating physical degrees of freedom. So if I now in 5 minutes go back to the black string, I have to ask, how do I address the issue of stability or otherwise of my black string? So those of you doing cosmology will also see this, where you decompose your perturbations with respect to the symmetry group of the spatial, the homogeneous and isotropic spatial section. So in terms of the black string, you've got an SO3 set of killing vectors, rotations on the two sphere. You've got d by dt and d by d psi or d by dz, whichever way you want to write it. So that means that you're going to write your perturbations in terms of an e to the I omega t or e to the omega t for an instability. You're going to have an e to the I mu psi, I guess 2 pi, I mu psi on L, and then you're going to actually decompose with respect to the angular momentum group. So in principle, your perturbations could have angular momentum. Now, I'm not going to talk about angular momentum perturbations, but I'm just simply going to note that in the 50s, Reggie and Wheeler, in a, I can't remember whether it was one, two, three, whatever, a set of papers actually worked out what the eigenfunctions were for a tensor field, a tensor mode with angular momentum in the background of a black hole. It's a very much a non-trivial calculation. You'll be used to looking at angular momentum of scalar fields, typically. And so you never really have to worry about the fact that the wave operator has a lot of extra connection terms. So on a scalar, your wave operator just decomposes into sort of LL plus one eigenvalues when you do the angular momentum part of it. Here, your wave operator on HAB is actually mixing different components of H because it's a tensor. So it makes it a lot more complicated. So your eigenfunctions of different angular momentum have very specific entries in the H. So it's quite a tour de force calculation. And that was, of course, before Mathematica. So it's recommend, if you think you have it bad, just go back to those papers from 50 years ago. So we can look at our perturbations. We have a scalar perturbation. We have a vector. So this is a bit like what we did in Kaluza-Klein theory, reducing down to 4D. And then, of course, we've got a tensor mode as far as our four-dimensional physics is concerned. Now, if I look at what the equations of motion are for these different pieces, I'll just focus, just give you one. Just take a look at the scalar mode, for example. You find that the Lichnerowicz operator on H55 is equal to the four-dimensional scalar wave operator I'm going to forget the two pi's on L, so let me just go e to the I mu psi here, and mu can just be whatever it has to be. So I'm just writing down what this wave function comes down to if I have no angular dependence. And you can see that the Schwarzschild potential, this V, comes in. You see that the mu squared is just like the Fourier mode for the extra dimension. And this is assuming an instability or looking for an instability. And so I get omega squared, and it's divided by V, of course, because it's got an inverse GTT sitting in there. So you look at large R. So this is typically what you do when you try and look for solutions. So in this case, if I look at the scalar mode, I can see that for a physical solution, I've got to pick the exponentially decaying mode at infinity, the mode that goes to zero at the horizon. And so my perturbation goes to zero at both the horizon and infinity. And so there has to be a turning point. But if I then looked at this equation for the turning point, at a turning point, it says that H double primed is positive if H is positive, which means you've got a minimum, or H double primed is negative if H is negative, which would mean a maximum. And so there's no way, if H had to go between 0 and 0, you have to have a maximum. So in other words, that's contradiction with your equation of motion. So what you do is you see that the same sort of thing happens for the vector mode, though it's a little bit more complicated. And then you zone in on this tensor mode. And it's an S wave because it doesn't depend on the angles. And then just to summarize the steps of what you have to do, again, you have to use the gauge conditions. So you've got essentially, the independent components of that are the T, R, and theta components. So you can rewrite K as a function of the other in this case, you can actually choose independently the trace of H and the divergence of H to vanish. And you can use that to re-express all of these components in terms of a single function. So there's a sort of underlying single degree of freedom H, which satisfies a second order ODE. Then you have to check all these issues about regularity, in other words, whether H remains small. And what you have to do is you find that you have to take an initial data surface, which ends on the future event horizon, and go into local Kruskal coordinates to identify. You're doing exactly the same sort of argument, looking for an exponentially decaying solution at infinity, and then looking for a locally finite solution at the horizon. So you identify that, so you know the asymptotics at each end, and then you have to see whether or not they meet in a regular solution. So that's the technique. And so you go through that process and you find that in fact there is a particular omega as a function of mu when this mu is less than, so mu is the wave number, is less than of order 1 over gm. So in other words, when the length is bigger than of order RS, which is basically what we saw from the entropy argument. So our horizon of the black string infinitesimally at least starts to wobble. We can't use this method to say what happens beyond the linear regime, but it's simply suggestive of the fact that the black string will split up and form black holes. So a couple of years back, Lewis Lehner, who's here, and Franz Pretorius actually put this whole system on a computer and then left it for a few months to see what happened. And what they actually saw was not only exactly this picture, but they saw the evolution went through to have sort of an apparent horizon which looked, first of all, like a sort of large black hole had formed, but then more interestingly, as they watched and waited, and this is where the time came in, they started seeing a sort of cascade of little black holes forming in between. So it's like as this sort of constant sort of subdivision and instability of each string forming these black holes. So it's almost like a self-similar behavior cascading down. And insofar as we can see, it does seem indeed as if the topology eventually changes. But of course, this raises issues all of its own, because it would seem like that would lead to a naked singularity. So that's at least the, I've sort of walked you through, first of all, I've given you the tools for doing perturbation theory, which is a fairly necessary tool in applied general relativity, and also given at least the key steps in terms of an exploration of a solution, which you had this reason, which you would have been perfectly justified not to believe, how, you know, this thermodynamic argument. You had a reason to suspect a classical solution was unstable. You go in, do a completely classical calculation, and find that indeed it is. So that's kind of yet another just bolstering up or justification of the whole notion of black holes and thermodynamics and how all those pieces fit together. So it's quite a nice story. And Lucian's about to come, so I'll stop.